series of the Vancouver Institute. I'm very pleased tonight to introduce Dr. James Kennedy, who will be well known to many of you. Dr. Kennedy did his undergraduate work at the University of Toronto in applied mathematics. He then went on to Princeton, where he did his PhD in theoretical physics. He then spent 14 years at Atomic Energy of Canada, rising to principal research officer. He assures me before any CANDU reactors were actually for sale. He came to UBC in 1966 as director of the Computing Center and professor of computing science. He's known around here for his intellect, for his objectivity, and for his sense of humor, and perhaps mostly for the latter reason, has served on a wide variety of university committees on various controversial issues. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Kennedy, who will speak on computers and how they got that way.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Institute, I've been asking the Associate Dean of Medicine what he can do for my throat before I started, and he hasn't cured it, so I better check that we're all right for sound with this thing. Can you hear me at the back okay? If you can't, you know the old rule. Well, what I want to talk about tonight is a story both of people and of machinery to trace some of the ideas that led to modern-day computers as we now have them, to take a bit of a look at the computer industry, and to touch on a topic that I think is probably dear to many people's hearts. I found that when I stray off the campus nowadays that anyone who accosts me said, oh, you're in computers, let me tell you this awful story about what a computer did to me. And I hope to have a few words to say about that before winding up. It will have been apparent from the introduction that I am a mathematical scientist turned administrator. I'm not a historian or a technologist or a futurist or a social philosopher of any of these things. I think the only excuse I can give for touching on all of these matters tonight is that regularly Saturday night's my night off. First, I'd like to say something about calculating machines of a period before there were computers, because one finds the ideas of computers developing sometime before anybody really knew how to make them. There has been, of course, the abacus around for 25 centuries in various parts of the world. But one of the first mechanical computers, calculators really, was developed by Pascal in 1642. That isn't it. Let's see if... This is an adding machine that Pascal developed in between being a philosopher and a theologian and a mathematician and all these other things. It would add and subtract. 30 years later, Leibniz produced a multiplying machine, one that would multiply as well as adding and subtracting. These, one would not say, are computers in the sense that we talk of computers nowadays, but they are forerunners of the present-day pocket calculator. They represent the desire of someone to have a gadget along so that he doesn't have to do arithmetic on pencil and paper. And the route to calculators turns out not to have come directly from these small machines, but by way of the large computers as a sort of spin-off. And later on, I hope to give you a bit of a picture of that. It was quite a time before the next significant mechanical devices were conceived. And the genius of the 19th century who had the conception of a computer was Charles Babbage. That's a picture of Babbage in early middle age. He was a very determined individual, very stubborn individual, a genius and eccentric. He got in a lot of, well, a number of his projects were frustrated by the scientific organization and the government and others. He died an embittered man at the age of 80. Pictures of him in later life show him as looking even more determined and angry than that. Actually, of course, after looking at those pictures of me that have been appearing in the Western News and Advertiser, I feel a little sorry for Babbage, and I'm sure that he really didn't look like that all the time. Babbage's idea was that a machine, a calculating machine, need not be run by an operator who thinks, what do I do next, and then does it by moving his hands, but that it could be controlled by a program. Now, when one uses, and the machine that he conceived, which was going to do all the operations of arithmetic and work unattended for prolonged periods controlled by a program, was known as the analytical engine. It was a conception that was flowed naturally from Victorian engineering of that time. People were devising engines of all purposes, and Babbage thought up the analytical engine. Now, when one talks about a program, this tends to conjure up, I think, a picture of perhaps something like this. This is a real honest-to-gosh program from a recent concert of the Vancouver Symphony. And you see it says right on it, program. They spell it in that peculiar way with the M-E on the end, which crept into the language to make things look rather precious during the 19th century. There's no more reason to spell program that way than telegram or anagram. Anyhow, this is a program. This says these are the things that are going to happen. It's all laid out in advance, and you can sit and know what it is that's going to happen. Now, that's a listener's program. It's not detailed enough for actually causing the thing to happen. But if one thinks of the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra as a music-making machine, it responds to a detailed version of that program. And here is part of that. The Brahms Symphony No. 1 was on that program. That's a detailed program for a music-making machine. You just need to get yourself a symphony orchestra, put that in front of it, and Brahms Symphony No. 1 will ensue, give or take some nuances of style. But undoubtedly, it's Brahms Symphony No. 1, and the advantage about having a program of that sort is that any time you want the symphony, you don't need to conjure up Joe Brahms to produce it. You conjure up a music-making machine and feed it the program. On a more humble scale, another sort of non-computer program, not many people know about these things anymore. That's a pattern out of a knitting book. And if one thinks of a person as a knitting machine, what one does is to respond in a mechanical way to things like knit one, purl two, cast off, and various simple things of that sort. And you don't have to be smart. You just have to be able to do a relatively small number of things and faithfully obey the rules, and fisherman's luck will inevitably ensue. And you'll notice there are decisions in it. At various points, you have to make decisions depending on which of those six sizes you're aiming at. Another programming manual that everybody has in their houses is a cookbook. You don't need to be a great chef to make great recipes. You just have to have the programming manual for making great recipes and to follow the instructions faithfully, and all those tremendous dishes will ensue. Well, that was Babbage's idea, that one should be able to have a calculating machine that would proceed to work by itself for prolonged periods controlled by a program. Now, the machine never got built, but that doesn't prevent one from writing programs for it, just as you don't really need an orchestra in order to compose symphonies. And there are a lot of unperformed symphonies that are symphonies nonetheless. So one can identify the first programmer as belonging to this period. And here she is. This is Ada Augusta Lovelace. Ada Byron by birth, Lord Byron's only legitimate child. She was a very competent mathematician, and during the 1840s, she worked with Babbage on the development of the analytical engine. She wrote accounts of it, and she wrote programs for it. Unfortunately, as I say, the programs actually never got executed, but one could read them today, and they do make sense. They look like the sorts of programs that people write for present-day computers in many respects. Lady Lovelace and Babbage worked very hard on the engine. They ran out of their first government grants and the second government grants and the third one too. They turned their joint considerable mathematical talents to working out schemes to beat the horse races in order to make more money for the analytical engine. And a lot of Lord Lovelace's money went down the drain on that. And in the end, the engine never really did come to pass. However, another feature which one sees in present-day computers was already thought up by Babbage, and that was the use of punched cards. If one is going to control the computer automatically, one has to have some way of getting information in and out. And Babbage decided that the thing to use was a punched card. He didn't invent the punched card. The punched card was first found in very common use in France. This is a loom designed by Joseph-Marie Jacquard early in the 19th century. And there were many tens of thousands of these looms in France by the middle of the 1850s. Coming down off the top of it is a string of punched cards with holes in them, which determine the pattern and move the various parts of the loom in such a way that one just has to toss the shuttle back and forth or whatever one does to weave. And the pattern is determined not by the skill of the operator, but by the stack of punched cards that are flowing through the machine. And Babbage's idea was that his computer, his calculator, would be run in that way. And one of Lady Lovelace's accounts of the analytical engine refers to weaving algebraic patterns, just as Monsieur Jacquard's looms weave patterns in silk. Well, the engine was never completed. Following Babbage's death, his son developed and completed parts of the engine, and that shows the calculating organ and the printer of it. It had the components of a present-day computer, a part that would calculate things, a memory for holding data, a place for reading cards, and some place for printing out results. You must remember that Babbage died before the electric light bulb had been invented. So there's no electricity in this thing. It was made with brass wheels and was going to be driven by a great steam engine. But it was far beyond the technology of its time. And it's perhaps not surprising that it was never really completed. Some years following Babbage's death, his son tried to get the idea resuscitated. And there was a committee of the British Association for the Advancement of Science that looked into Babbage's engine and just tried to decide whether still more government funds should be poured into it. They decided that while it was a great and majestic conception, that the world was not yet ready for it and that there should not be further funding. And these ideas were set aside for about 3/4 of a century. However, there's one rather interesting note in their report. They looked and considered applications of the machine and what it was capable of doing and the calculations that might be expected to go on with it. And they gave a warning that care might be required to guard against misuse of the machine, especially against the imposition of Sisyphean tasks upon it by influential silists. You see a fine turn of Victorian prose. And a warning which one still finds is probably has some validity a century later. Well, the analytical engine went into repose without ever being completed. The punched card, however, did resurface in another context before the end of the 19th century. And that was in the Bureau of the United States Census, where Herman Hollerith a young engineer with the Census Bureau, noted that they were having increasing difficulty keeping up with getting one census processed before it was 10 years were up and it was time to do another one. And he devised the notion of punched cards for census takers to get the information. And the idea was they were just going to punch holes in these with a thing like a conductor's ticket punch. And these cards would then be automatically processed. And this is part of the equipment that was used for the processing in the United States Census of 1890. Electrical, you see, there's a nice bunch of batteries down in the bottom of it that were driving the whole business. And cards went in, and they get sorted into pockets on the one side, and counters of the number of times that certain things happened were racked up on that device on the left-hand side. The Hollerith subsequently developed or set up his own company to market punch card machinery. After selling it out a couple of times, it's the company that eventually became IBM, so that there is a continuity between Hollerith's punched cards of the 1890s and the computers of today. Well, still before computers as we know them reached the scene, the idea of the essential strength of a computer was examined in a theoretical way in the 1930s. And what I want to turn to now is to try to trace where this notion of the general purpose computer, programmable device that will do anything for you, comes from. And the two names that I choose as being significant for that are, first of all, Alan Turing, second, John von Neumann. Alan Turing was another English eccentric, although this one more or less of our time. He was born in 1912. He was an eccentric genius. His most significant paper, the one that is sort of the foundation of theoretical computer science, was written in 1936 when he had just graduated from Cambridge and was on his way to Princeton to become a graduate student. During the war, he was involved with very secret work at Bletchley, which is only now becoming publicly known, having to do with the project for breaking the main German code, the German ciphers, and he was involved with the design of special purpose machines for working on that. Following the war, he was the designer of the pilot ACE computer at National Physical Laboratories. He made further contributions to computer science before his bizarre death in 1954. He was found one morning in a deserted cabin where he was living by himself and doing some thinking with a cyanide-coated apple by his side, and it's never really been satisfactorily explained. He was a very eccentric chap in many ways, quite apart from computers. He used to like to go for 10-mile runs. If he only had to go 10 miles for something, he was as likely to jog there as to take any other means of transportation. And he was a great lover of children's radio, even throughout his adulthood. His 1936 paper was actually intended to be a profound piece of logic, but the language in which he couched it turned out to make it much more significant to stimulate the thoughts of many more people than it would have if it had simply been a paper about logic. He wanted to start to try to formalize the process of calculating as people calculate, with the idea that one could then make statements about what things are calculable and what things are not calculable. And in the course of doing this, he formalized the act of people writing numbers on papers and thinking and doing operations and writing additional answers down in something that he called a machine. Now, he wasn't thinking of building such a machine. It was just a formal notion. This, roughly, is the sort of machine he had in mind, a very simple-minded thing which had a piece of tape on which symbols could be written and... Let's see, I think there's a marvelous device here with an invisible arrow on it. Yeah. The idea was that you could that one could scan one symbol at a time. The machine was capable of erasing the symbol and writing another symbol in its place. It had little would have little sprockets to move the tape back and forth. And then the mechanism of the machine was that it could be in one of a number of states. This particular machine, which is one that's capable of adding numbers together, if designed to go with that table that's over there, it had six states. And Turing's idea was that for any calculation that one could think up such a machine, that is, define the table for its operations, and the one could then convince oneself and prove theorems that say, yes, this machine can calculate all the numbers of that particular class. Now, you can see this is not a machine that anyone was intended to, expected to build. However, it was not a complex machine either. The type of the type of machine one was thinking of, a bit like soft drink dispensing machines. A machine has a it has a number of states. It's full of Coke and out of Sprite, and it's got quarters for the change but no nickels, and it's got three dimes left, something like that. That's the state of the machine. When you come along and supply it with some input, which in this case is probably putting in a coin and pressing a button, then there will be some output, which may be change, or it may be a bottle, or it may be nothing at all if the machine is empty, and the machine will change its state into something somewhat different. So that these machines that Turing was thinking about were really no more complicated than that. And they don't, in their way, look all that impressive. However, Turing proceeded to prove two very remarkable results. The first of these was that for any problem of calculation that a person can carry out, one could devise a machine of this type which will do it. And devising a machine really means inventing a table like that of what the machine is to do if it's in one of its states and sees one of the possible symbols on its tape. That is, that any calculation that a person can do can be done by a suitably designed Turing machine. The second thing that he proceeded to prove was that you don't need a special machine for each calculation. You can devise a single machine, or in fact a class of machines, such that this machine will do the calculation that any particular machine will do if only you give it the right tape. That is, one has a universal machine which will have a very clever table like that, and depending on what you put in as the input tape to this machine, what symbols are on this tape when it starts, it will carry out any particular calculation that is required. And what this points out is the possibility of swapping between designing clever machines and designing clever programs, because what is on the tape is in effect a program for the universal machine to carry out any particular calculation. And the formal proof of this is that one really sort of puts onto the tape a kind of Heathkit description of the machine, the particular machine that would do the calculation, and you say to the universal machine, don't build the machine, but any time you have something you have to do, look up on the tape what it is that what part of the machine would do that, and then go off and do the thing yourself. Deadly inefficient way, apparently, to do things, but nonetheless, in principle, what it says is that any calculation that can be done by a person with pencil and paper following some procedure that is laid out that the person knows can be done if you only have a universal Turing machine sitting around to do it. And these universal machines don't have to be terribly complicated either. It was a bit of a competition amongst students and professors in the 1950s to try to devise the minimal Turing machine that is capable of doing anything, and one that uses an alphabet of four symbols and has only seven states, so that it's only about twice as complicated as that little picture on the side, is capable in principle of doing any calculation whatever. Well, this notion of Turing's has got embodied in something that is now called Turing's thesis, and it's sort of the computer scientist's creed, this notion that if there is a recipe that a person can use to get results by the use of by performing logical operations, then you can do it on a suitable computing machine. And when I say it's the computer scientist's creed, I don't mean that they all stand up and face the east every morning and put their hand on their heart and say it. But I think some of them do. A further extension, which I don't plan to go into today, a further extension of this notion of Turing's was given by Turing himself back along about 1950. And it gets down to, well, what is a recipe, what is a thing that a person can do by the exercise of logic? And there is a sort of behavioristic view of people which says that anything that a person does under the exercise of intelligence, whether the person can say how they do it or whether they can't, is in fact being carried out by that machine called the brain following logical operations. Therefore, in principle, anything that a person can do by thought can also be done by a machine. And it's this notion, this extension of Turing's notion, that leads to the whole field of artificial intelligence, machines that will play games and do things for which people can't describe how they do them, and which if people do them, you think it's intelligent. What do you call it when a machine does it? Well, this area of artificial intelligence is a highly controversial one. Good for at least three lectures at this institute. I don't propose to pursue it. What I want to do is to turn to where the real computers finally began to come from, because Turing was talking in the abstract. There still were no computers on the scene at the time he was thinking about these matters. Computers were a child of the Second World War, really. Switching devices that would move at slow speeds in the form of relays were available prior to that. But the idea of using vacuum tubes and electronics that would produce rapid switching of things on and off, which are really the basis of the insides of all these machines. I tend myself to think that there's a little person inside the machine actually reading it and doing the stuff, so I'm not good on hardware. But to make the things really go, one needed devices that would switch on and off at very high speeds. And the electronic tube was the key to that. And while there's considerable controversy about who invented the first computer, quite a number of lawsuits running now about patents on early computers, and so I don't want to try to claim who was the first. Names such as Aiken at Harvard, Eckert and Mockley at the Moore School at the University of Pennsylvania were amongst the early computer designers, Konrad Zuse in Germany. But what is generally acknowledged to be the first electronic computer was built by Eckert and Mockley at the University of Pennsylvania and put into operation about 1943. And it was a giant beast. It had 18,000 tubes. It said that the lights dimmed for blocks and blocks around when they turned the machine on at the University of Pennsylvania. And this is a part of it. It is not a computer in quite the sense that we now think of them, because the programming of this machine was done by wiring up those plugs into holes. All this gubbery on the front and certain of these other panels along here, one did the program by plugging in wires and putting things onto the face of the machine. Babbage, you see, was really long forgotten at this time. and really his ideas only resuscitated during the 50s as computers began to take hold. And people said, oh, but someone thought about all that before. And Turing's mathematical papers hadn't had their significance on design at that point. So this first machine, while it kept all its data inside, it was programmed from the outside by plugging things into patch boards, things of that type. It was von Neumann who was influential in bringing forth the idea that is at the heart of present-day computers. Von Neumann was in Princeton at that time. Von Neumann had tried to hire Turing as a research assistant at the beginning of the war. He was certainly familiar with his ideas. Turing went back to Britain instead. But I think one can see Turing's notion of program as the key to universality of machines in von Neumann's idea that the program for the machine ought to be in the memory along with the data. And he was guided, in part, I think, by the notion of the human brain in which, you know, everything you need is up there, the 12 times table and all that sort of stuff, and the program for finding your way home at night and for doing calculations and all the rest of that stuff. And von Neumann argued very convincingly in the late 1940s that the machine should have the program stored in what he now called the memory, in the same way that the data was, in order that the machine should be a truly flexible calculating device. Here is von Neumann and Oppenheimer, along with Oppenheimer, at the dedication ceremonies for the Institute for Advanced Study Computer in Princeton in 1952. This was not the first machine to von Neumann's designs. Nor did von Neumann for the 2 years that I was in Princeton, and we never saw him. There was a high hedge around the house, and there was a dog that barked a lot at night, and I'm ashamed to say that on my landlord's insistence, I once called the Princeton police and complained of the dog. But I didn't know he was thinking up computers. However, I was in Princeton in 52, and there was von Neumann and Oppenheimer dedicating the computer. Meanwhile, developing out of the Eckert-Mauchly designs came the first manufactured computer, the UNIVAC 1. Eckert and Mauchly, you know what professors do when they got a neat idea and they can't get funding, they go and form a company. And Eckert and Mauchly went to work for Remington Rand and designed computers and got very rich. So that the computing industry began about this same time in 1951 with the first of the UNIVAC machines. Now, I want to turn to what's gone on in the computing industry, give you a sort of bird's eye view of a few developments in the 25 or so years since these early computers. At the time that one's talking about, there were only about half a dozen computers in the world developed in various universities, research laboratories, and so on. But with the coming of the UNIVAC 1, the industry began to take off. Sorry, every so often I'm stepping on my cord and damaging the mic. Well, I better show you something about programming to give you an idea of the flavor of what people used to do for mathematics, and to some extent still do, if you have a little mathematical problem and you want to solve it on a computer. This, I think, is probably pretty well invisible, and that's just as well. It's a little program about right-angle triangles, which one that we quite often inflict on students in computer science courses around here. So find right-angle triangles whose sides are integers, such that the two short sides are one unit apart. And if one wants to solve the problem, one has to have, first of all, think up the so-called algorithm, the recipe for the procedure for going about doing it. And what I've sketched down at the bottom is a hint of a procedure
a student who can think this little procedure up first time round is doing fairly well. Most of them don't quite manage this. You need, of course, to know something about right angle triangles. The fact that one needs is sort of stuck in the middle down there. The thing you need to know about right angle triangles is that the sum of the square of the, no, the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. Pythagoras theorem. Since the Bernofsky lectures have become so popular, everybody knows Pythagoras theorem. And so what I've sketched down at the bottom, and the person who did the sketch for me apologizes for the fact that those balance pans looked like a lemon. We couldn't find a good ellipse. But these are the two pans of a balance. And one has got the square on the hypotenuse, and the other has got the sum of the squares on the other two sides. And you'll notice that that one is balancing. That's because those are drawn to scale, and that's the famous 3-4-5 triangle that everybody thinks of right away as the right angle triangle. But the scheme for looking for all of them is just try balancing. If this pan is low, put a heavier weight on this one and see if it makes it higher. If this pan is high, try that one and see if it tips the other way. Every so often, the two pans will balance, and then you write down the answer. Well, having thought that up, if you were a 1950s-style programmer, you would then write yourself a program. Well, no, you wouldn't quite write a program. I threw that one in because I came across it while making up these slides. That you're supposed to plan all this out and make a flowchart of all the steps and do it very tidily. That's not the flowchart for this one. That's an early flowchart of von Neumann's that was contained in a letter to a friend around 1947. So I present it to you for its historical interest. Even von Neumann didn't get everything right the first time, you see. That's a program for a computer. What that actually is, that's been written for the machine we have here at UBC, an IBM 370, and it's written in the machine's language. And this brings up the point that what machines are full of at any given moment is a whole bunch of zeros and ones. And you can see why it is that programming was regarded as a bit of a chore in those days. I mean, you had to sit and get all those details right. And while one might get abbreviations, in fact, these are blocked off in groups of four because it's common to have a single symbol for each block of four. But basically, what people did in the early days was to write programs for the machine in the machine's own language, and then they'd punch them on cards. And there is a conventional IBM card, and with considerable difficulty, because this has gone out of fashion, I have punched that program on this card. Actually, only half of the card, about this half of it, contains all of that stuff, and the remainder of the program is on that, or almost all of it. That and about one more card like it, if fed into the machine, would give it all it needs to know in order to perform this calculation. Roughly speaking, there is a hole in the card for every one that there is up on the slide, tastefully placed with the places where there are no holes representing the zeros. Well, that's why it was PhDs that did all this programming. You know, only such people would be so interested in the answer to anything as to want to sit and do all those dinky zeros and ones. But that substantially was the way calculating was done for the first 3, 4, 5, 6 years of the computer industry. Machine language, or something very close to machine language. A significant development of the middle 1950s was the idea of problem-oriented languages instead of machine languages as a way of writing down one's programs. And of all the people mixed up with programming, the one that I choose to show you to epitomize the development of programming is the inventor of Fortran, John Backus. I've been looking around a bit apprehensively to see whether computer science profs have been coming in. There are people who invent programming languages in the computer science department, and there's a very distinguished inventor of programming languages who's visiting the computer science department this week. And all of these people would agree, though I don't necessarily, that Fortran is really a sort of rotten language and one shouldn't tout it. But nonetheless, it was the first widely used problem-oriented language. Backus's idea was it is not necessary to write everything in the language of the machine. You can write it in some suitable language that's more suited to the problem at hand, something that people would enjoy doing. And then one gets it translated into machine language by some lower level person or thing. Well, the person or thing is the computer, the same computer that's going to ultimately do the calculation. Von Neumann's pushing for the putting the program inside the machine along with the data was because he saw the machine doing minor modifications to its instructions as it worked. It turns out that the significant implementation of von Neumann's idea has arisen through not changing the odd instruction as you change the course of the program, but in this wholesale production of machine language programs through automatic translation of the program out of the language in which people write it. And it was Backus and two of his assistants who persuaded IBM to put them up for 2 years on full salary, working in a basement, inventing a programming language and inventing a translating program which would take it into the machine and turn it into computerese. And the language they devised was Fortran. What I put up here, this is the end of the programming course. At the top of the page is a Fortran program for solving that little problem. And you don't really need to know anything about programming to be able to read it and see part of the flavor of it. There's the M side of the equation, and there's another NSQ, which is N squared, and you see it comparing these two and printing. And in that sort of language, one can write down one's thoughts relatively easily. One then turns it over to the machine for translation into all those zeros and ones. And just as an added bonus at the bottom, there are the answers. This one is asked to look for all the solutions with all the sides less than 1,000. And you see the 3, 4, 5, and a few of them that you haven't yet got up there on the back with your hand calculators. Well, nowadays, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of languages. They tend to be invented for all sorts of purposes, where one wants, where has a certain class of problems, and one finds it's difficult to use any of the existing languages to explain them to the machine. So one takes 6 months off and invents a new language which will do that and writes the translator for it, and then that puts you in business. So that there are now, as well as Fortran, which is the old faithful, dozens of languages that are very widely used throughout the world, and as I say, hundreds, I mean literally hundreds, 200 or 300 anyway, of sort of private and special purpose languages that people have devised for explaining their problems. The upshot of this is that programming is easy. You see, you don't really feel you need to know very much in order to be able to write syntactically correct Fortran. And that's true. On the other hand, the quality of the product really depends on whether you have a good algorithm or not. It's not the syntax that you should be proud of. It's whether you have a good method of solving the problem. In the same way, I could teach this audience to write music, playable music, in a very few minutes. If you're a scientist, I mean, all you need to know is that that's the time axis running horizontally that way, and the distance out away from me is proportional to time, and that's how you know when to play the note, and that the vertical axis is pitch. It's a logarithmic scale of pitch of vibrations per second, and that it's graph paper, and there's a mark on it that says where the origin is. And it's, say, logarithmic graph paper. Being musicians, it's not quite scientific graph paper. Each pair of lines is either a ratio of 6/5 or 5/4, depending on which pair it is. But that's a minor detail. And with modern music, that hardly matters at all. And then you just put blobs on it. And then you get an orchestra and they play it. And it will be sound. They will know what to do with this stuff. I mean, that's really all there is to writing music, except it's not very good music. Well, there's one other thing about music. There's a theorem in music that the more care that you lavish on the note as you draw it, the less time the performing machine will use to play it. You know, the round empty ones are long notes. If you put a tail on, it gets shorter. If you fill it in, it gets shorter too. That again shows that music is not a science. But as with music, the same is true with programming. It's a cinch. Oh, here we go again. It's a cinch to learn the how to write stuff that looks okay, and you might even get it played if you could find people to play it for you. But whether it's good or whether it's bad depends on the underlying thought that went into the recipe, the algorithm, to use the official buzzword, and that flowchart of what are the steps that one wants to carry out. That's what makes a worthwhile program and a piece of trash different from each other. You can't tell to look at them. It's only if you try them out that you find that some are good and some are bad. So present-day programming is this individual creative craft, because there aren't really rules of good style and that sort of thing. There's quite a lot of argument about what is good programming style. It's an individual craft in which it's easy to learn the fundamentals. And the quality comes from the quality of the thought that lies behind it. Computer technology itself, I've said I don't really understand the insides of computers too well. But what has been happening with the technology is that faster and faster switching devices are being found, and these get to be smaller and smaller, and they then allow computers to work faster and faster. And between the early computers, which used to do a multiplication, say, in a few thousandth of a second, and the present-day machines, which will do it in a few billionths of a second, one has about two factors of 1,000 in speed up. A factor of 1,000,000 speed up in the last 25 years in the rate at which these things work. Now that in part is quantitative. I mean, it's just the same way that some cars go faster than others or a car goes faster than a bicycle. But it really is more than that. When one talks about factors of speed of that nature, one really changes what things one would contemplate doing with such a machine. One factor of 1,000 is the difference between crawling from here to Toronto at 0.5 mph or flying in a commercial jet aircraft at 0.5 mph, which is about the speed these things go. And one simply wouldn't start crawling to Toronto at 0.5 mph. So one factor of 1,000 in transportation speeds changes the idea of where you would consider going for a day or a week. And a second factor of 1,000, well, heaven knows what we'd be doing then. Well, this has happened in computers twice, these factors of 1,000 in speed up, once during the 50s and once during the 60s, roughly speaking. And it has had a great effect on what it is that one can imagine doing and getting the answers while they're still fresh enough to be interesting. Well, a lot of this has come through the miniaturization of circuitry. The velocity of light, while very large, is nonetheless finite. It takes 1/1 of a second for light to go 1 foot. So if you want your computer to do work in a few billionths of a second, you've got to have the whole darn thing in a 1 foot sphere. Otherwise, you can't get signals across from one side to the other fast enough. So that the miniaturization of circuitry is at the key to getting faster and faster machines. Here's a chunk. You'll only barely be able to see this if I put this on here. This is a piece of UBC's first computer. It's got a couple of tubes on it, you see, and a whole chunk of material like this. That, with the tubes, went out with the invention of the transistor. And from more recently then, one has had monolithic circuits, these whole computers on a chip, things of that kind. I've brought a couple of pictures. I cheated, actually. The scale on that is wrong, if you can read it. It's not 0.55 millimeters, it's 0.55 centimeters. It was a fifth of an inch, and I thought I should go modern and convert to metric. I didn't get my calculator out, did it incorrectly. But that, roughly speaking, is one-fifth of an inch square. It is the whole of what is now known as a microcomputer on a single sort of chip, and then one surrounds it with enough gummery to be able to get messages in and out through these pins around the side. And there one has something which is much more potent than the old ALWAC, which used to have some hundreds of these sitting in it to do the work. So this is, this is the way technology is moving. Indistinguishable from a distance is that one in which the scale is correct. That's also another sort of fifth of an inch on the side. That is the guts of a Texas Instruments hand calculator. And it, too, has a single chip in which all kinds of interesting things, the equivalent of thousands of transistors and other elements, can be etched. And out of these, one makes the calculators, the microcomputers, and a whole spectrum, mini-computers, midi-computers, giant computers. It's all a matter of how many of these things one puts in the box as to just what its power will be and what it will do. But the technology at this point has advanced to the stage at which one can get very potent calculating devices on something that's less than a square inch, just a little wafer. And this is going to continue. The research is in hand for making them still smaller. One gets to the point that it gets pretty hard to do all that etching on them where they're so small. And electron microscope techniques are going to be needed for the next round of these to make more and more interesting things on smaller and smaller chips. But that sort of thing is proceeding. And one could therefore expect that computers and calculators and like things will get cheaper and cheaper and smaller and smaller. Well, the pocket calculator, which is the last of my slides, sort of turns up as the end of a very long circuit which went through the very large computers, and then as the computers got smaller and smaller, one found that it was possible to begin to get all of the things you need in order to do quite a lot of calculation onto a small piece, and then you can devise some neat things to put around it and package it neatly and sell it for anywhere from, well, I don't know what they run now, $5 to $500, depending on how much oomph you want. Well, these trends are going to continue. The economic force that drives it is that the unit cost of doing things with a computer gets smaller and smaller as time proceeds. These devices become increasingly more efficient, and the cost of doing a million multiplications or whatever you may feel like doing on any given day gets to be smaller and smaller. Meanwhile, the cost of hiring people to do these things gets larger and larger. And it's inevitable that people are going to look for ways of using computers and computer-like devices. The other sort of spin-off, the microcomputers and the pocket calculator side of it,
is the development of all kinds of little smart things, not full-fledged computers, but smart devices which have little control elements in them, sewing machines in which it's a small computer, a microcomputer, that determines what the stitch is going to be instead of you having to change bits and pieces. Those nice games you can buy, you know, play Pong on your television set and so on. These are all done with computer-like devices. And as television programs get worse and worse and computer programs get better and better, one has to assume that more and more TV sets will be used for as adjuncts to computers rather than as part of the sort of piped entertainment industry. Well, that still doesn't explain why everyone wants to tell me these horror stories about computers. But I do want to sort of draw two or three of the ideas together and try and make a few half-baked observations about computers in present-day society. First of all, we have Turing's thesis. Turing's thesis is a great encouragement to people who want to compute things. It says, if you know how to do it at all, then you can do it with a computer. Then there's this economic point that I've mentioned, which says it's cheaper, getting cheaper and cheaper to do things with computers compared to doing them other ways. And then there's the third one, which is that thousands believe, millions believe, that programming is easy, and therefore that it isn't really a difficult proposition to take some job that you do at the moment with a battery of people and cause it to be done on a dirt cheap computer. Well, if all that's so, one has to ask, you know, why hasn't heaven arrived on the earth and the computer's doing all the work while we sit and enjoy it? And the first of these things that goes against it is that thinking up good algorithms is still hard, just as thinking up good musical compositions is still hard. And one tends often in saying, oh yeah, well, we've got the whole work of this office, let's slap it all on a computer. One tends to neglect the fact that the office is really a very complex sort of thing. You can, and the boss will say, we're going to automate it. And that's a bit like writing, and they say, here are the things we're going to do. And that's a bit like writing that program, first program I showed you for the symphony concert. You know, it says Brahms' piano concerto, Brahms' symphony. Brahms' symphony has four or five movements in it. It says, okay, let's do all those things. And that's a bit like the impresario saying, okay, we want a concert, we want some new stuff, go and tell Joe Brahms to stop writing those songs, get on with the symphony, and it's to have start with Allegro Maestoso and go on from there. Well, that's all right if you've got Joe Brahms in the house, but it may not be if what you have is a stable full of hacks. The second observation is that computing is an industry. It's a big industry in North America, in Canada, in the world. And it's an industry that's supplying majestic machines for this domestic programmer's craft on which there are no real principles that underpin it. Programmers write programs the way someone taught them to write programs or the way their first programs worked. One can't really say that computing is a profession in the sense that engineering or law or medicine are professions. There is no body of knowledge which one must have and pass a few minimal exams in order to set yourself up as a computer expert. It is the law of the marketplace which determines which so-called computer experts will prosper and which ones will go down the drain. So when you have a stable full of programmers, or you pick a consultant out of the yellow pages, how do you know what you're getting? So it's an industry. It's not a profession. Maybe it'll become a profession. some people, when this is mentioned, have some sort of awful things to say about the established professions, and I don't think I should dwell on them in front of this audience. The third force that gets proliferation of computers is that IBM intends to remain profitable in the face of technological advance. IBM is a $15 billion a year business, and they don't intend to lie down and play dead. And if it is cheaper, getting cheaper and cheaper to do the given jobs, why is anybody going to get rid of their old computer? Computers don't wear out the way automobiles do. You know, you can keep using them for years and years and years. IBM and all the computer corporations rely on expanding the applications of computers in order to expand their markets. And believe me, having spent a couple of days down at IBM headquarters being brainwashed last November, there is no doubt in their mind that they intend to remain profitable for the next decade. And that involves more applications. And since computing is a very competitive industry, that means the others will all be in the marketplace too. And one finds a lot of sales of marvelous programming packages that will save you, you know, or new computer application. In the 1960s, it was management information systems, which nobody understood even before or after the management information fad. The idea was that the boss should have a typewriter connected to a computer in his office, you know, that sort of thing. Well, bosses don't want that kind of thing in their offices. In the 1970s, the big word is database. Database systems. I won't try and tell you what it means. It means what the latest salesman wants it to mean. But the underlying principles for a good database system, I think, are not yet understood. Well, these manufacturers' representatives, though, with all the goodwill in the world, and I'm not knocking them, I don't want to foul my own nest any more than I can help, they are trying to sell their products to people who have not previously computed. And there are people who don't consult the experts before buying a computer and putting in a marvelous system. And those, I suspect, are the ones that frequently cause us the trouble. The other reason that organizations put in computers is to save money. It's not to improve the service. It's not to improve the downtown skyline, if that's why people design great majestic buildings downtown. This is something that's going into the back room to save money. And by golly, it's going to save money. Otherwise, it's not a success. And if it turns out to be harder to write the system the right way, and running overtime and so on, cut, cut, cut. The urge is there to cut the corners, take out the safety features, take out the one that will fix it up if someone calls in and say, you've screwed up my account. Leave that part out because computers, quote, never make mistakes. And one, I think, sees a number of systems which got put into use before they were ready, and once they're there, it's very hard to get them out. The other thing that's true about computers, and one sees it in some of their applications, is that it's a great centralizing influence. The boss may not want a terminal on his desk connected to a computer, but once the computer system is in and all the transactions of the firm go through the great central computer, judgment and control tends to get vested in the head office, and very little of it seeps out to the periphery. And this type of organization is no doubt nothing wrong with it, I guess, as long as it all works at the head office. It's when it doesn't work at the head office that the people on the outside, on the periphery, are getting all the flack and are helpless. Well, that's about where we are. There are a lot of good systems. These are the ones you don't hear about. And there are some bad ones, and these are the ones you do. I think this points out that there are still many opportunities for computers, and there are still many dangers that may come about, some of them through wickedness. Though I'm not one who believes, you know, that computers are going to sort of take us all over and rule us. But the possibility for wickedness is there, and the possibility for shoddy implementation of great ideas is around, and that can be just about as bad. On the professional side, I think it behooves
those of us who are connected with computers, to try to see that things are done well before we get regulated. On the part of citizens, I would say, when someone says, the computer says you've got to do that, or something of that kind, you should just go. Now that would be a good place to stop.
In case there is anything that you do not now know about computers, Dr. Kennedy, answer questions, as is the custom of the Institute.
Dr. Kennedy, do you know anything about the projected use of a checklist society because of the implementation of a central computer for everybody and its possibilities?
Yeah. The question was, what about the checklist society that one hears about? There certainly is considerable pressure to have this. The banks like it, so the computer manufacturers, of course, love it. There are a couple of problems that one can foresee, and I think they touch probably on the two dangers that I mentioned. One is ineptitude. It's a very large, complicated business to decide to do the whole of the financial transactions of the universe without passing pieces of paper. And one thing that's become apparent in computerized crime is that auditors have not altogether kept up with neat, clever programmers and computer operators when it comes to wanting to pinch the assets of the firm and set up phony accounts and things. Auditing of computerized records, fully computerized systems, has not really kept pace with the desire to implement these systems. The other thing is that the banks have not really shown that they're all ready to implement computer systems at all. Why my bank on this campus has got some inert terminals that have been sitting there for 2 or 3 years because they were going to put in a system for that bank, and they blew it. 200 people worked for I don't know how long, and the darn system wouldn't work. So there is this danger that it may not be done well, and I have heard of people who have used some sort of Instabank cards or something who find that far from the transaction being done instantly, that the transaction may take 6 days to get to another bank, even in the same city. The other one, which concerns many people, is the question of the whole question of the invasion of people's privacy. Once one is in this position, there then will be, in effect, central dossiers of all of your financial transactions. Now, once that's the case, two things can happen. I mean, one is that people can break them into them and steal them. I mean, after all, if burglar-proof vaults can be ripped off, why not burglar-proof computing centers? So that, actual crime could take place, or that in the absence of sufficient legal protection people may start to do wicked things with your files, like read your private files to see where you were last week if they want to go after you for something. And the law on this subject, what you can and cannot do with a computer is really in a very primitive state. It's not clear just how much privacy one is entitled to in these things. There are few pieces of law pertaining to it, but I think that I would like to see us go rather slow on that one.
Washington Post, I heard a story. They tried to put a lid on it. Why is that? Is it that the public should be aware?
Well, I guess if I can hear the question, everybody must have. It had to do with why does IBM try to put the lid on tales about computerized crime? I don't know that IBM necessarily does. I mean, it's you who said that, not I. But there's no doubt that any organization that gets ripped off or burgled or anything else, and of course it wasn't the IBM, it'd be one of their clients, does not want to advertise how this is going to be done or how easy it is to do it. And if that causes one to sort of want to keep the tail under the rug, well, IBM, I don't control IBM.
Yes. Kennedy, what success have the railroads had in keeping track of their rolling stock?
Well, the question was, what success have the railroads had in keeping track of their rolling stock? I don't know. Most of you will be aware that railway freight cars and other cars began having a peculiar code on the side of them some years before the internet, the universal product code with a whole bunch of bars has begun appearing on everything. The idea behind that was that as railway cars go flying past certain spots, scanners get them and feed this into a computer, and that way somebody's going to know where all the railway cars are. But I don't really, you know, I've heard that it didn't work as well as somebody expected, and I've heard that it worked well, and I don't really have any information on it that would say.
Yes. Just in the idea that if the human mind can think about it, you can perhaps program it or do it by computer. Is it anticipated that the human mind would be able to be reproduced without sense?
The question was, if I have it right, drawing on the analogy of the computer and the human mind, but turning it the other way around, does it mean that the human mind could be reproduced without sex? I don't know. It was really touching on a subject that which I'm far from qualified to speak, which has to do with what is the essence of a person? Is there more to a person than a machine? Is everything that we do governed by intelligence and intelligent logical operations, or is there something else inside? And the artificial intelligence argument, to say, is really basically a behavioristic one that says that many of the things, or that anything that a person does that reflects his intelligence, can in principle be done by a machine, and that what they work on is ways of having machines do things for which the recipe is not well known. But turning it in reverse is getting even further from my field than I usually stray.
You've described how on the one hand computers become very pervasive in our society, and on the other hand, there's still, after 25 years, have some problems, computing science problems as a discipline. In view of that, what would you recommend putting into our elementary and high schools about computers if you could control what went to the elementary schools and high schools?
The question was, what should be a curriculum about computers in the elementary schools and high schools? I'm very unsound on curriculum, you know. I mean, I'm not going to tell you the whole story of why I'm not really a prof, but within the computer science department, my thoughts on curriculum are regarded as quite unsound. But backing off a bit from the question, the BC Committee on Education in Computers, or Computers in Education, has been looking at recommendations, working with the Department of Education on possible curriculum for the high schools, and it tends to head towards one sort of technical course on programming,
And then the argument begins amongst them about what shall be the first programming language that a student encounters. But that's not really a terribly significant problem except to the specialist. And then, in addition to the idea, I mean, school children love it. You know, it's more fun than doing some of the other things you do at school. And the other then has been talked of is something about computers and society. Now, that happens to be a topic of which, at this university, there is a fourth-year computer science course. And I tend to think that's the approximate level of maturity that one wants in order to appreciate these things. And I have some doubts about trying to patch that sort of thing into the school curriculum. So my present advice to these people, which they may or may not take, is don't hurry. First thing one wants to do is discover why there should be some need for it other than good, clean fun at that level, because you're going to have to take something else out of the school curriculum. The second is you're going to have to get teachers so that they know what this is all about and not just preach it out of a book. And then we'd be ready maybe to do something. So I'm hedging.
Yes.
Well, in talking about computers in education, I wasn't necessarily referring to computer-assisted instruction or computer-assisted learning. It is coming. There's been quite a lot of work done on it in a number of places, notably the University of Illinois and in this country, primarily, I guess, the University of Alberta, on using a computer instead of a teacher, with a script within which responds in rather more clever ways than these self-teaching books do to the answers given to students, given by students to questions. The province of Quebec has recently decided to go in for this in a large way. They're taking the Illinois Plato system, was marketed by Control Data Corporation. It causes considerable heartburning in the educational profession as to whether, in fact, a machine is as good as a teacher or not. And at the moment, a lot of it depends on the amount of care that has been lavished on preparing a script. Because once again, just as there are good teachers and bad ones, if you start out with thousands of people learning something that is not the lesson as would have been given by a master teacher, you can downgrade the matter. So it's in the experimental stage. There's very considerable urge by the manufacturers to have this happen. I don't know if the teaching profession is quite that enamored of it.
Yes.
What, on BC Systems Corporation? Not really terribly usefully. The question was a comment about BC Systems Corporation. I thought it was going to be about ICBC, but I'm relieved. BCSC has not yet really gone into operation, so there isn't the same amount to be said. The provincial government has discovered that computing is not well done in the provincial civil service, that computer applications are not as widespread as they probably ought to be, and what things that there are not being done as well as they ought to. I think the premier's word was the computers ought to be going zip, 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 and they aren't. And the proposal is to bring all of the computer work within the government under a single umbrella and improve it. Now, whether or not this will happen remains to be seen. It's being done by bringing in a group of new talent from outside, and about 30 new positions, and superposing it onto 300 or so computer people that already exist in the civil service. It involves rearranging the physical computers that the government now has and trying to get more out of them. I got off a line at the Computer Society on this that really the thing that's a bit discouraging is that they appear to be trying to skirt disaster and strive for mediocrity. I point out that coming from a university where we say we're striving for excellence, that I find it a depressing sort of thought. But then, of course, it's remarks like that that make the university sound so elitist, and I can't help that. It's going to be interesting to watch. The question is, what advances have been made in artificial intelligence? Well, there's a lot going on, some of it at this university. The two or three trends in which most of the work is going, one has to do with computers that will deal with natural language, be able to carry on a conversation or understand what's being said without one having to do rigidly structured things. And a second has to do with playing games. You know, the thought that a computer would be really intelligent if it played chess and beat a master has sort of led to that as a line of endeavor. Chess is a pretty expensive one, but working out strategies for games in which one knows sort of some principles about the game but doesn't really know how a person thinks up the next best move is a second area. The third one, which you have to have a big budget for, is building robots, which will actually work with a TV camera scanning around its environment and taking in these signals and out of that reaching decisions about what it is supposed to do, having been given some rather general goals and objectives that it's supposed to carry out. One of the purposes for that is if you want to get something to go out onto the surface of Mars, you know, and scout around and dig things up, possibly bring them back, that there's a 40-minute time delay for signals to get to Mars and so on. So you can't do it like a vehicle on the moon in which you could think of steering it from the ground. If you saw it heading for a precipice, you couldn't get the signal up that says stop. And so you have to really, if you want a vehicle to tootle around on Mars, and, you know, instead of just digging with its arm, you have to give it some goals, like find interesting rocks and bring them back to the thing. Well, there's been progress on this, but it's whether, the argument about it is whether one is just creating better and better mimics and finding a bunch of ad hoc procedures for patching up and making it slightly better than the last one, or whether one is really deriving out of this some comprehension of how thinking is done. And artificial intelligence has its great enthusiasts and has its very severe critics as well. But it depends on which type you meet as to whether there is a lot of progress or whether there is really just sort of probing around but nothing very much to report.
Yes.
Are there any benefits that the computers have contributed to our society in the last 25 years?
Are there any benefits? Oh, yes. I mean, one tends not to hear about those. I mean, a great number of the sort of ordinary things that go on and go on reasonably well, like designing buildings that don't fall down and aircraft reservation systems that actually, you know, you find when you get to the airport there's a seat on the plane. All of these things are computer applications that in which the computer is used in a very essential way in getting the result. This perhaps points out, in some of these, my bias as a scientist. I still like to think that the urge for computers, because we want to do great, majestic calculations of things that were important to calculate but too hard to do with pencil and paper. And there's now a great deal of that goes on. It's on the replacement of low-grade clerical tasks in which one is relying on large volume of trivia going through the computer in which one tends to get into the difficulties. If you were watching CBC TV last night on the Hourglass, they showed a banned film, but it wasn't porn. It was a computer thing about oil spills in which they have a program based on that is capable of predicting, given tidal information and various things, how what will happen if an oil spill takes place at a certain spot. And they had used data from the Arrow oil spill from some years ago and other things to get their model, and they showed some rather interesting predictions of what would happen if something spilled on the way to Cherry Point and things of that type. there's a lot of use of computers in that type of work and doing things that one would be quite unable to handle in other ways.
Yes. Do you anticipate in the near future that homes will have terminals and that, for example, the great libraries of the world will be instantly at a beck and call?
The question was, should we anticipate terminals in the home connected to archival libraries of the world? Yes. Whether in 10 years or whether in 20 is a bit hard to predict. But that type of thing is being very seriously studied by librarians, both in this country and elsewhere now. And I think it's one of the, together with linking up of different computers in different places in order that they may share programs and other data, that one is going to see developments along that front before too long. Before too long, meaning the turn of the century, you know, as we ooch on toward the millennium. The question was, could you use the computer instead of big weapons, if I get you right, that because the computer could send a small bomb to blow up the just what you want to blow up, that you don't need to have big bangs. Because Canada does not have a large military research establishment, and most of what is done in this is sort of secret, I don't know really how things are going. But you would appreciate that most of the smart devices that go zooming after things, and there are many of the smart devices that go zooming to the right place and explode, have computer-like things in them in order to steer them en route. And there are ones that chase the exhaust of jet planes and so on, but there are others that are controlled by computer to go to the right spot and do their thing. Whether that's a good use of computers or a bad use of computers, I suppose, depends on whether you're sending or receiving.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we should spare further wear and tear on Dr. Kennedy's voice. I'd like to ask Professor Chitty if he would thank Dr. Kennedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, as one of Dr. Kennedy's minor customers, it gives me great pleasure to have been asked to thank him for tonight's lecture. I'm not going to tell him what a good lecture he's given, because that was obvious to him from your rapt attention, but I would like to tell you how fortunate we are at UBC in our particular setup here with our computer facilities. I don't want to talk about the hardware, which is indeed among the most outstanding on the continent, but I want to talk about the atmosphere in the computing center, which is unmatched anywhere on this continent, and that is entirely due to Dr. Kennedy. On this campus, we have a simply wonderful system for getting the ordinary Joe like myself in touch with these fearsome instruments and these astonishing intellects that are clustered around it. When you're doing research work nowadays, it is all the difference between the jet age and the horse and buggy age, as it was when I was doing my research. One has these astonishing data processing systems, but there are also some disadvantages. And one of these is this. In the old days, when one had a student who was writing a thesis, one would duly make one's corrections, and the thesis would go back for repair, and you could guarantee at least 2 or 3 weeks before you were pestered again. Now, with the wonderful facilities down at the computing center, the student can get the corrections through, rush through the revised edition, and come back within a day or so, and you have to read it all over again. Now, we have to take the good with the bad, but on balance, I think we will agree that we have to thank Dr. Kennedy very much indeed for everything he makes available to us. And thank you again for your delightful lecture.
Close this evening's session and call your attention to next week's lecture, which will be by Dr. Alex Woodside on China and Vietnam, the New Era.